The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
We absolutely support Israel's right to defend itself in line with international law.
We need to safeguard financial stability.
2024 is not going to be an easy year.
We used to call it the dream of home ownership, but look at Britain now.
We've got to hang on to optimism and hope because it is the biggest driver of change.
Let's stop thinking of life in terms of Brexit. Let's move on and look to the future.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. Welcome to the programme. Coming up a little bit later today, we're going to talk about NatWest, a bank that's still part owned by the government, and Bloomberg's latest reporting teeing up a share sale of part of that stake that could feature in the budget next week.
Yeah, absolutely. But of course, it is Wednesday, Prime Minister's questions. We'll get to that in a moment. MP safety has been a topic on the podcast all week. The government has announced a £31 million funding package to improve MPs' security.
Politicians are increasingly concerned about pro-Palestinian protests, the cost, the pressures on policing, and the concern of whether these protests are crossing the line into intimidation. So the government's considering increasing the notice period that protesters must give police for demonstrations. But also there's a concern about the tone of the protests from the Home Secretary, James Cleverly, and the Deputy PM, Oliver Dowden, saying the point has been made. Let's go to the House of Commons and listen to Keir Starmer.
That Britain is run by a shadowy cabal made up of activists, the deep state, and most chillingly of all, the Financial Times. At what point did his party give up on governing and become the political wing of the Flat Earth Society?
Mr. Speaker, another week where the Honourable Member is just sniping from the sidelines because he has absolutely nothing that he can say what we do. What we're getting on with, Mr. Speaker, is delivering on the people's priorities. The number of small boats down by a third, Mr. Speaker. NHS performance improving, inflation continuing to fall. And Mr. Speaker, not only that, we're delivering a significant tax cut for millions of working Britons. While his incoherent energy plans would put taxes up for everyone across the country.
Mr. Speaker, his predecessor spent last week in America trying to flog her new book. In search of fame and wealth, she's taken to slagging off they made her Prime Minister, now they can't bear talking about her. In search of fame and wealth, she's taken to slagging off and undermining Britain at every opportunity. She claimed that as Prime Minister she was sabotaged by the deep state. She also remained silent as Tommy Robinson, that right-wing thug, was described as a hero. Why is he allowing her to stand as a Tory MP at the next election?
Mr. Speaker, I don't believe a single member of this House supports Tommy Robinson, Mr. Speaker. But Mr. Speaker, if he wants to talk about former leaders and predecessors, the whole country knows his record because he sat there while anti-Semitism ran rife in this party. And not once but twice backed a man who called Hamas friends, Mr. Speaker. But to their credit, the Shadow Chancellor, the Shadow Home Secretary, and indeed the Shadow Foreign Secretary refused to back the former Labour leader. But he didn't, because he's spineless, hopeless, and utterly shameless.
Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I've changed my party for the better. He is being changed by his party. The reason he's letting her stand is because he's too weak to do anything about it. It's the story of his leadership. When they refuse to accept any blame for the ruin of the last 14 years, you do wonder who they think has been running the country all this time. Thankfully, the former Prime Minister's on hand again to help. It turns out it's all the fault of the media, the corporate world, and bizarrely, the President of the United States. Winston Churchill once said, "The price of greatness is responsibility." Now, I don't think the British public are expecting greatness from this Prime Minister, just a bit of accountability. So doesn't think it would be great if, just for once, the Tories actually took some responsibility.
Mr. Speaker, he talks about leadership, he talks about change, but when I learnt of something that I didn't agree with, I suspended one of my MPs straight away. But when he, but Mr. Speaker, when he learnt of vile, anti-Semitic remarks made by a Labour candidate, what did he do, Mr. Speaker? He instructed his team to defend him. He sent a shadow cabinet minister to campaign for him, and he personally backed him for days. And that's the difference between us. I act on my principles. He hasn't got any.
I can't believe he's saying it with a straight face. The former Prime Minister continued on her American odyssey. This journey into the wild west of her mind. She also claimed, Mr. Speaker, that Nigel Farage is the man to restore the Tory party. Can the Prime Minister confirm whether he too would welcome Mr. Farage back into the Tory fold?
Mr. Speaker, in our party, we have a proud tradition of diversity and accepting everyone from every background. Indeed, it is a proud record that puts Labour to shame, Mr. Speaker. This is the party that delivered the first Jewish Prime Minister, the first female Prime Minister, the first Black Chancellor, the first Muslim Home Secretary, and now led by the first British Asian Prime Minister. While it seems he can only champion men from North London, it's the Conservatives that represent modern Britain, Mr. Speaker.
So this diverse Tory party does welcome Nigel Farage. The Prime Minister, two months ago, the Prime Minister said the Tory party is a broad church. I welcome lots of people who want to subscribe to our ideals and our values. This is the same Nigel Farage who said he agreed with the basic premise of Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech and bemoaned the influence of the Jewish lobby. So is the Prime Minister simply too scared to stand up to the gaggle of Tory MPs who moonlight as GB presenters? Or does he genuinely think Nigel Farage shares the ideals and values of the Tory party?
Mr. Speaker, he wants to talk about values, but tomorrow in Rochdale, the people will have a choice of three former Labour candidates, two of which are anti-Semites, Mr. Speaker. The truth is, his party is so mired in hate that despite three ex-Labour candidates standing, he can't back a single one of them, Mr. Speaker. It's because we expel anti-Semites, he makes them Labour candidates.
Mr. Speaker, the truth is these are no longer the Tories your parents voted for, and the public can see it. The Prime Minister has lost control of his party to the hordes of records and malcontents, the tinfoil hat brigade over there, the extremists who wreck the economy, all lining up to undermine him, humiliate him, and eventually to get rid of him. When will he ever stand up to them and end the pathetic spectacle of a Tory party that used to try and beat Nigel Farage, now giving up and dancing to his tune instead?
Mr. Speaker, utterly shameless from someone who stood by while anti-Semitism ran rife in his party, oversaw the appalling situation in Rochdale and twice backed the member for Islington North. And in the last few homes, Mr. Speaker, last few weeks, we've seen members of Parliament's homes surrounded, their events disrupted, council meetings threatened, and just last week we saw the very rules that govern this place abused because of intimidation, Mr. Speaker. While he might want to bend to mob rule, we will face down the extremists and stand up for British values.
So that was Prime Minister's questions, and wasn't it a testy one? We were wondering whether this would be a more muted affair or whether there would be real sort of electioneering in the offing. And I think it was nothing other than really quite personal. And we talked a lot about Liz Truss and her appearance at the CPAC event in the United States. And that is where the opposition leader, Keir Starmer, began, talking about how she was undermining Britain, how she talked about having been sabotaged by the deep state, sort of ridiculing Liz Truss as a Conservative former leader for this conspiracy theory.
Arguably, Liz Truss has featured more in Prime Minister's questions while she hasn't been Prime Minister than when she did when she actually was in the job, because it was an interesting choice by Keir Starmer to decide to highlight, that particularly controversial intervention or speech that Liz Truss made while on this trip to the United States promoting her book, as Keir Starmer pointed out, but also how Rishi Sunak chose to respond to this and point to the anti-Semitism controversies in the Labour Party, and how, as he points out, Keir Starmer was there in the party during past controversies, but also the actions around the candidate in the Rochdale by-election, of course, had the Labour Party ticket removed from him.
Yeah, and the Rochdale by-election, remember, is tomorrow on Thursday, and the Prime Minister pointed to three former Labour candidates standing, and that Starmer couldn't back a single one. But a few interesting lines, plenty of jeering and cheering, but the trip into Liz Truss's wild west of her mind, I thought, was quite memorable. Cries of shameless from the Prime Minister on the other side.
Yeah, there was some mention there too of that issue that we started the programme with too, about MPs' safety too. That did come up in the conversations as well. But as you say, this felt very much like a pre-election discussion, very much pointing to those who are going to the polls tomorrow.
Yeah, but I also thought that it was very legalistic, wasn't it, again, in how Keir Starmer laid out his point, trying to hold the Prime Minister's feet to the fire in terms of Nigel Farage. Is he the man to restore the Tory party, as Liz Truss was saying? Would he be welcomed back into the Conservative Party?
Well, this is, as you know, we're into the fifth day now of the controversy over the former Deputy Chairman of the Conservative Party, Lee Anderson's comments too, that he made about the Mayor of London, and these questions as whether Lee Anderson, did he have this meeting with the leader of the Reform UK party as well,
and perhaps
is that a direction that Lee Anderson wants to go in as well? So that's tied into, of course, the Nigel Farage story too, is, you know, that he is effectively being courted by more than one party, it would seem.
Absolutely. And but then the Prime Minister was able to say, look, when MPs, he didn't mention him by name, but Lee Anderson, say things that he's unhappy with, then he suspended the MP straight away. And he pointed to Keir Starmer's actions when it came to the Rochdale candidate, how long it took for that to happen. But yes, all fundamentally around this, the bottom line being around the tensions that these parties have on one side around around anti-Semitism, and on the other, prejudice against Muslims. And so, this politics around identity and around faith is very much front and centre for both.
Yeah, and the heated levels of rhetoric being seen from both parties there as well. That was this week's Prime Minister's Questions. Now, we want to talk about NatWest, and to do that, let's take you back to a very different House of Commons, the Parliament of 2008, the global financial crisis that arrived in the UK, pushing several high street banks into crisis. Up steps then-Chancellor Alistair Darling to announce a rescue plan, a multi-billion pound bailout of Lloyds TSB, HBOS and Royal Bank of Scotland.
Mr. Speaker, the government does not want to run Britain's banks, it wants to rebuild them. The long-term future of UK banks lies in the private sector, and we will aim to sell the public share in the participating banks as soon as feasibly possible. But our objective today is to stabilise and rebuild, and we will maintain our stake for as long as it takes to do that.
The Conservative Shadow Chancellor at the time, George Osborne, was unimpressed.
This is the biggest bailout in the world so far, paid for by the biggest increase in debt by any peacetime government, funded by the £11,000 of extra borrowing that will now be heaped on every family in the country. And so the British people are in no mood to celebrate. They want to know how their taxpayers' money is going to be protected, how quickly they can get it back, and how on earth they ended up footing the bill.
Well, now, more than 15 years later, it is a Conservative Chancellor who might be looking to sell the last of the shares that the government acquired during that financial crisis. The government wants to sell the final 33% stake in NatWest by 2026. And Bloomberg has learnt that it has started talks with brokers on a retail sale for this year. So to help put all of this into context, we're joined by our city editor, Catherine Griffiths, and our finance reporter, Will Shaw. Welcome to the programme. Catherine, NatWest is a bank with a long history. Just talk us through its importance in the UK banking landscape.
Yes. Well, it's one of the UK's biggest banks. It has brands that go back many, many decades, more than 100 years. Royal Bank of Scotland, NatWest, Coutts, all of these sort of famous names within its stable. And then, as you referred to, it had a sort of real moment in the spotlight 15 years ago when it nearly collapsed. And the government at the time had to step in and stop that collapse. And it wasn't the only bank around the world to be in that predicament by a long way, but it was certainly one of the most dramatic. The bank had been led by a swashbuckling chief executive, Fred Goodwin, in prior years. Goodwin had led this sort of controversial, even at the time, hostile takeover bid for Dutch bank ABN AMRO. The consortium pulled that deal off. There was lots of sort of high drama. But then in short order came the financial crisis. And RBS, as it was known at the time, got into a sticky situation, partly because of the sort of swashbuckling consortium hostile takeover, partly just through more straightforward reasons. Like many other banks, it had lots of loans extended to small businesses, particularly, that then went a bit wrong. But also, crucially, it was ran with this sort of wafer-thin level of capital, which meant that it didn't have a sort of good cushion when it came to problem times. And again, that was the kind of the view at the time, that you sort of made your capital work. You didn't sit on a big amount. But Goodwin was a kind of leading proponent of having this really quite sort of tight capital in order to do these dramatic things.
So the government steps in with this bailout in 2008. The bank lives on, rebrands as NatWest Group at some point in a few years later. What's been the story of NatWest since 2008?
Well, it's been, you know, up and down. Again, it's the story of the UK economy in many ways, like other big banks. But NatWest is the UK's biggest lender to businesses. So while that's an incredibly important position that it holds, and, you know, very largely that works pretty well, but it has certainly had a few scandals. And really, the biggest that dogged it for a long time was this sense that it had treated small businesses at around that time of crisis and thereafter in an unfair way. The sense was that coming out of the crisis, it sort of very aggressively assessed their ability to be going concerns, and that it perhaps didn't give them a fair hearing, and that it sort of put some of them into, it made them fail in a way that it shouldn't have done. And that was a really sort of toxic, long-running row that really kind of bogged the bank down, and it was very political, and it struggled to get out the other side of that.
Yeah, that whole idea of debanking and, you know, the impact on the real economy sort of started, I think, really at that point. Since then, though, the government stake in the bank has also meant, kind of has brought with it, obviously, additional scrutiny, including including quite recently with the CEO Alison Rose. She had to resign last year about this controversy over Nigel Farage's bank account.
Yes, she did. And in some ways, the two are actually linked because all of that sort of historic stuff about whether or not NatWest had treated its small business customers fairly led to a situation where, under Alison in particular, there was a view that the bank needed this sort of purpose, very kind of explicitly written sense of purpose, that banking generally and NatWest in particular had to play this really sort of wholesome, active role in society. And Alison, who'd actually been a very long-standing employee of the bank, when she became the boss, really set out that idea. And then from that flowed this enormous crisis with Nigel Farage, which no one really seemed to kind of, at the inside the bank, realise that it was going to be so toxic. But because Alison and some others had said, right, NatWest has to have this sort of real sense of the kinds of customers we want and the role we play and what we believe really is not kind of acceptable, it led, through one reason and another, to Nigel Farage being told he was going to have his bank account taken away. Obviously, there's another side to that story too, which is that he was a customer of Coutts. If you are a customer of Coutts, you have to have a certain amount of money. And then there was quite a lot of to and fro about whether he actually had that amount of money.
So that brings us closer to where we are now. Will, I'd like to bring you in at this point, because we've been talking about the government's ambition for this sail down of some of its stake in the bank. What is the government exactly planning?
So the stakes are quite high for the government and for NatWest here, as Catherine was mentioning. The government has still got about a 33% holding in the bank. As of Tuesday, that was worth £6.7 billion. There's a lot of expectation that during the budget on March the 6th, Jeremy Hunt will confirm plans to try and sell that down over the next year or so. The UK has open talks with brokers. Those include Hargreaves Lansdown and AJ Bell, about trying to sell these shares off to retail investors, like essentially a subsection of the taxpayers who bailed the bank out in the first place. Those talks are at an early stage, and we know that the government has asked the brokers to sign non-disclosure agreements. We also know that M&C Saatchi, who are sort of titans of advertising during the Margaret Thatcher era, have been called in to help sell this to the general public.
And that is, you know, the heart of the scoop that you brought to Bloomberg, you know, the revelation, because we knew it was going to happen, but it's about exactly when and how. But I wonder, Will, is this basically going to be a decent deal for the UK taxpayer? Because my maths isn't probably not as good as yours, but it doesn't look very good to me in terms of what the sale price might be.
I suppose I'm kind of reluctant to get too much into a question of like value for money. I mean, it's interesting. Someone was pointing out this morning to me that £7 billion, according to the Resolution Foundation, is what it would cost to make a one pence cut in the base level of income tax, and that there sort of might be a match there. That might be what the government is thinking about here. There are a number of difficult issues that the government will have to grapple with, like not least that this is likely to begin going into a general election. There's a risk if an unpopular government, as we know from opinion polls, there's a risk that if it associates itself too much with this share sale, that could put buyers off. The government will also be keen to make sure that the whole of the country are aware of this and are able to take part, not just wealthy people in the southeast. And the real challenge here, I think, is that you or I together, or anyone else, could buy shares in NatWest today. So it's very different. I mean, people are drawing comparisons between the famous Tell Sid campaign in the 1980s, where British Gas was sold off by the Thatcher government. That was a genuine privatisation. here, the prospect is much more prosaic, really. Like, we can already buy shares in NatWest. The government's just going to try and persuade us to buy more.
But that's an interesting point, too, about the significance of putting, Catherine, that sort of public interest into getting people excited, essentially, about NatWest shares, presumably in the hope that it'll work out neatly financially as well.
Yes. So I think Jeremy Hunt will probably say something along the lines of, we're going to sell these shares off, and he won't necessarily say, I'm sure he won't say next week, at X discount or anything like that, but clearly the sale will come with a fairly sort of juicy discount to the prevailing share price, and of course that's the way normally these things work, there is a discount. But he will try to make the wider point that it's part of this government's push to get more retail shareholders engaged in owning stocks in this country, that's so key to the sort of future of capitalism, of business, and, you know, a thriving economy, that there's a wider engagement of stakeholders. And it's not just, we're not just seeing this in the UK, actually Europe is in the same position too. They look to the US in particular, and they think we must have more people across the country who actually care about the companies here. So the government will try to offset the slightly awkward point about, yep, we're going to make an enormous loss on this sale compared to what we paid back 15 years ago, with this sense of, but there's this wider purpose.
So then where do you think that leaves the UK government's relationship overall with the banking sector? I mean, as we've talked about, you know, the government has been very involved really in the banking sector for a long time. Does this mean a clean break for perhaps the next government?
So I think it's very interesting from the point of view of the relationship with the banking sector. Jeremy Hunt had a group of banks in a few weeks ago to say, you know, why are your share prices so bad? What can we do about it? And they all sat round and felt quite cross because, you know, some of it's the economy, some of it's the world, but they think some of it is huge political intervention. So on the one hand, they feel cross about things like ring fencing rules, which mean they find it difficult to kind of really sort of finance parts of their business. But on the other hand, you've now got this government that's highly motivated to sell NatWest stock. I mean, the reality is there's no way the government will kind of go easy on some of these regulations in order to boost the NatWest share price. But I suppose there might be this hope, perhaps, that if Hunt comes out and makes quite sort of positive, supportive comments about banks, that might actually help the wider sector.
Well, what would a NatWest without a government stake look like? And what sort of what are the future prospects for the bank now? What are the big challenges it's facing?
Well, it might have a bit more independence in terms of how it makes decisions. I mean, the problem that NatWest faces at the moment is that it can get a call from a senior government official and it basically has to do what it's told. I mean, we saw that very much during the Nigel Farage incident. The chair of NatWest would have liked to have stood by Alison Rose during that row. As we understand it, the government intervened and NatWest just had to do what it was told and push her out.
Well, Catherine, I was a financial journalist when I remember the 08 financial crisis. I was in the US, but I knew what was sort of going on in the UK as well. I wonder if you could just explain to a political listener, you know, the fallout from the global financial crisis in the UK, that there are a lot of people who remember that time. It was an immensely difficult moment, and we're still trying to understand how that crisis was dealt with by government and whether government handled it well enough. You know, I don't know, Catherine, what is your view now with that 15-year perspective?
I think it's had an enormously long legacy. And actually, in the context of the UK and Europe, you can see it in the way the Brexit vote was framed, and arguably even it may have factored in the end result. You know, financial services is such an enormous part of the UK economy, for example, and yet it got no mention really from the UK government at the time, because it was not seen to be acceptable to the country to make the case for what what might be seen to be sort of fat cat city bankers who'd been bailed out by taxpayers. And instead, we had to hear endlessly about fishing rights and farmers who may well be very important constituents of the country, but they are not overall particularly key to the long-term success of the economy. So I think it's just such a sort of powerful way in which the crisis was still playing out. And undoubtedly, that's less so now. And yet we still see these flare ups. So, for example, the Labour Party had a big business day recently and they came out with a financial services document. And actually, some people thought it was a fairly interesting, thoughtful document. And yet really the coverage on the day was dominated by what they thought about bankers' bonuses. And that goes all the way back to what happened 15 years ago.
OK. Catherine Griffiths, our Society Editor, and Will Shaw, our Finance Reporter. Thanks very much for joining us.
Now, I thought that was so interesting, didn't you, about what Catherine was saying, how the story has come so full circle. I mentioned I was financial journalist in 08. There was such rage about, you know, how the, you know, the collapse of the financial system in many ways in the US that bled across the world and into the UK, that in some ways triggered austerity. There was real anger about it that Catherine was mentioning. And yet that has come full circle. And, you know, how much of the UK economy do we want to be powered by financial services is still a really big question.
Yeah, and this idea also of what filters through into people's public perceptions too, it'll be interesting to see when the sale does come around and somebody does crunch the numbers on what value for money has been done, whether that narrative will return, because it's been largely a lot calmer than it was in the height of the 2008 crisis as well. So will that come back into the political conversation as we move towards the general election? Will again financial services face a microscope that it hasn't in such a controversial way in more recent years?
Yeah, and of course there'll be a focus on it because it's simply so much money. I mean, the state could be worth something in the order of £7 billion. And, you know, that is a sort of big tax cut, for example, could be potentially, or help for local councils.
Indeed, which we have some more Bloomberg reporting on today, the difficulty facing local councils. Half of them fear bankruptcy in the coming years, our colleague Tom Rees has been reporting. This is from data on the local government information unit as well, with the warnings of what's that going to mean in terms of funding for things like parks, leisure centres, arts funding, and this idea of how austerity has actually affected over a very long period of time, and perhaps in a way that is only becoming visible now, and whether people, when they go to the polls, be it in local elections in May, be it in the general election later on, will vote on the issue of the fact that their swimming pool isn't open as long, or that arts facility that was there before isn't open or isn't doing as much as it used to be.
That annual survey of local councils talking about, you know, the possibility of cuts to come because of the budget pressures for local councils.
Well, that is it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe to us. Give it 5 stars so other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by James Wilcock and Mia Dawkins, and our audio engineer was Maruful Hussain. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. We'll be back with more on Bloomberg UK Politics tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.